Words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today you will hear the 13th in this series of 14 literary dialogues on the Psalms as great human documents, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, last week we expatiated at some length, I think, on the concept of peace and security in some of the Psalms. The man who feels himself completely at one with the world and with the divine power. But many things in that phase of the Psalms, as in others that we discussed before, were left out. And before we pass on to the next subject, I do want to include certain ideas which I think will be helpful in understanding that phase of psalmody.
You mean the phase that has to do with peace?
With peace, calm, and a sense of direction, even when there seems to be chaos in the universe. There are some very marvelous expressions of that feeling, as in the 68th Psalm, the psalmist is assured, when you lie among the sheepfolds, the wings of the dove are covered with silver and her pinions with the shimmer of gold. Yeah. A wonderful poetic expression of a man's feeling that whatever surrounds him is for his good.
Yes.
Or again, the mention of the Psalm of Moses. Do you remember we read that? I think it was last time or the time before.
The 90th.
The 90th Psalm is. It's an echo. The reason I think they've called it the Psalm of Moses is because it's an echo of the blessing that Moses gave in Deuteronomy. The eternal God is a dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Isn't that a powerful expression?
Yes.
You imagine some, well, if it isn't blasphemous to say so, some super Atlas,
yes,
who instead of with his shoulders, with his arms, holds up the whole of the universe.
And you remember in that psalm, Moses, if it is Moses speaking, says, again, one of those remarkable things that remind you of how time was considered. Time had to be considered somehow in terms of eternity. There were times before times. He said, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God.
Thou art, yes.
See, the present instead of
the present fills, in a certain sense, there is no past because it's gone. There is no future. It's not here.
Right.
The only thing we have is the present, and the moment we touch it, it's disappeared. It's become,
yes,
part of the past. Nevertheless...
No, excuse me. Well, all right, it has become a part of the past, but while it's here, it's eternity.
Yeah, there is nothing else.
Because eternity, the thing most like eternity is the present moment.
Well, that's why they, I suppose, one of the philosophical reasons why they call God the ever-present, that he is the eternal. Yet the knowledge of cycles comes through again in this idea of, or in this examination of serenity. In the 126th Psalm, I don't remember whether we touched on that... a great phrase which has gone echoing through so many poems and compositions. They who sow in tears shall reap in joy.
Yes.
And the Hebrew, Azorim bedima berina yiktzoru, it's in four words. And I ask myself sometimes, is it necessary to sow in tears in order to reap in joy? Is there a sort of necessary connection that if we don't labor, sweat, and agonize over something, there is no bliss in the fulfillment?
It's quite possibly true. You're asking me a pretty big question to answer,
yes,
answer on,
yes,
the spot. I would say it is all probability true. Every good thing, well, remember Spinoza remarked that every good thing is made with great trouble, made with great effort. That's true of any work of art. It's true of of the world as it was created. It's true of the birth of a child. I mean, every living person started in an agony of effort on the part of himself, of his mother and himself.
It came out crying.
Yes.
The same thought, I suppose, is implicit in the 118th Psalm with another famous statement, the stone which the builders have rejected has become the chief cornerstone of the building. That's recurs in the prayers of the Jews. Now, the reason I ask it isn't just for the general philosophic examination of that question. It's something else. In recent times, modern times, or lately, in a general way, there's always a feeling that any kind of frustration is bad. And the psychologists have a kind of a chant or a watchword that frustration leads to aggression. The implication being that if you'll take away frustration, there won't be any aggression. Now, supposing you were to rephrase that in just ordinary, simple, straightforward language, give a man what he wants and he'll never be angry. The logical consequence of which is, give the man whatever he wants.
Yes, and never cease to do so.
And never cease to do so. This is issues for me as a question from this examination of they who sow in tears. Isn't there such a thing as creative frustration? Isn't frustration necessary and a welcome thing, a necessary part of human motivation or the human drive?
Well, I don't think it's ever desired. Anyone would like to do whatever he does easily, and it's true that some great things are done easily. Some of the greatest works were done quickly and easily. I think sometimes these days, at least in the field of the study of art, we sometimes tend to magnify the importance of effort, at least a visible effort. In my opinion, the greatest of all musicians is Mozart, and he seems not to have had the slightest difficulty in writing anything that he ever wrote.
Well,
he wrote it, wrote it just the way.
Those are the blessed geniuses. When they when they say that the highest form of art is to conceal art, it doesn't mean to say there wasn't any art, any labor put into it.
That's true.
You've got to conceal the effort, but the effort was there.
Yes, that's true. But if the works of Shakespeare, for instance, had presented themselves to him as problems, he could never have solved them. No amount of effort could have written King Lear if you hadn't had the genius. And the man who wrote that wrote 36 other plays. It's utterly unbelievable.
Some of them are quite rubbishy, aren't they?
No, some are better than others, of course.
No, I wouldn't put it that way.
Some are not as good as
others. Some are worse than others.
Yes.
I think, for example, that the Merry Wives of Windsor is a pretty sloppy piece of work.
That's not interesting.
Don't you think so?
No, but
do you remember?
Say 30 then instead of 36. No one ever did anything like that, and he did it easily, and his contemporaries were bitter because he did it easily. They sweat and roared and boomed and bellowed about how difficult it was, but it was not difficult for him any more, I suspect, than it was difficult for the psalmist to write the psalm.
Do you think that it came fairly easily?
I suspect so.
Well, I sometimes have my doubts about it. I imagine that even Shakespeare... Shakespeare is, as we say, out of this world, almost in the sense that the Bible is, and perhaps he abused the divine gift that was given to him. You remember it was said of him that he never blotted a line.
Yeah.
And then one of the critics observed that he should have blotted a great many.
Yeah.
Perhaps if he had worked, perhaps we may be divided on this point, he was just too careless. He scattered with a prodigal hand.
My point, it doesn't make any difference. My point is this. We don't know whether the psalmist had difficulty or not. In the absence of any evidence, I think it's just as likely that he had no difficulty as that he had great difficulty, because it is true in the realm of art that the difficulty is not of any very great importance in itself. It isn't what makes the work good. What makes the work good is whatever makes it good. I mean, it's what's in it is the thing that counts.
Well, maybe it's that a man has to struggle in order not to let any dross or too much dross accompany the gold. But when you move from the sequences of the Psalms of Serenity and into the field of praise, there is more evidence for what you're saying, that praise itself doesn't come out as an effort. It's something which is spontaneous, and not merely spontaneous, it's irrepressible. A man gets up and just wants to shout, "Hallelujah, I'm alive." And it takes the form of all these marvelous variations. It takes the form of praise. And I think we once said a couple of years ago in talks about the Bible that praise belongs to nobody but God.
Yes.
That one shouldn't praise anybody but God.
Well, one, in a way, never does praise anyone but God. We compliment one another. We offer one another tribute of that sort. But, well, as I think we once said, there's nothing more absurd than to imagine complimenting God. One praises him.
Yes.
Because he is the ultimate recipient of whatever praise is. He is... It's in his completeness, and it's in his complete abstraction that you find the reason for calling him God. When we praise one another rather than compliment one another, of course we do praise great men, we praise qualities in them. We don't praise anything personal in them.
Or at least one should. One should try to avoid inflating the ego of the person. Just recently I came across a statement of Sidney Smith's. You remember the English clergyman who was such a wit.
Oh, yeah.
And he says this, which is very pertinent, very sharply put. It says, "Among the smaller duties of life, I hardly know any that is more important than that of not praising where praise is not due."
Yeah.
You know, we want to be nice to people, and so we follow the general notion of the man, whoever it was, that wrote a book called How to Win Friends and Influence People. I forget who it was. He had better be forgotten, I think. You praise them.
You make everybody feel good.
You make everybody feel good. It doesn't matter a hang, apparently, whether the praise is deserved or it isn't. You know, like on radio programs or on TV, give the little girl a big hand before she's performed, you know.
Yes.
So that it'll make her feel good and inflate her and go on from there.
Well, now, of course, the great point about the praise which the Psalms render to God, and I'm not sure about it, it's the greatest thing that they do. Many people thinking of the Psalms offhand, and they would include me, may think of them as substantially and at their center poems of praise of God. The great thing about them, of course, is that the praise is of course due to the subject. That's an understatement. That's a very faint statement about it. The praise is so due, so necessary to those who want to give it at any rate, or for those who want to give it, that they cannot restrain themselves. That is where the effect of spontaneity comes in. They sing praises unto God in all forms and in all phrases, as if they couldn't help it. They're overcome with their desire to do it. And their desire to do it is not to make God feel good. Because I'm sure their conception of him was lofty enough to understand that they were not praising him because he desired to be praised or needed to be praised or had asked to be praised, but because it is a noble thing to praise. It is the sign of greatness in anyone when he can praise.
Yeah, there's a charming story by Peretz. We've talked about him before, you know, one of the three great modern Jewish classics, Yehuda Leib Peretz, who describes a certain young Jew arguing with his father or his uncle. He said, "Wouldn't you get sick to the stomach if a man went around telling you all the time, you're great, you're wonderful, you're marvelous, you're incomparable, you are the master of the situation? Wouldn't it make you sick?" The man said, "Yes." He says, "Well, now, don't you think it makes God sick to hear all of this adulation poured out at his feet every day?" The fellow said, "Well, I don't know what you're..." "Yes, maybe, yes, but a man's got to do it."
Yes.
A man's got to do it. A man has to praise. This is not something that... when you compel a man to read these things, you compel, or try to compel a man to share these sentiments is because you're falsely transposing that situation to the merely human. You know, there's a saying in the Talmud that a part of man's praise may be read in his, may be told in his presence. The whole must be said only in his absence.
Yes.
Now,
After his death.
After his death. Now, it's quite otherwise when one wants to chant in sheer exuberance of appreciation, something like that. You flower out in gleeful happiness. What a marvelous world it is, and how marvelous must be the power that created it.
Yes, that's it. I think there's something, as it were, compulsive about this praise. It just must be given. The man or the men who have it in them just must let it forth. They can't help themselves, and they tend to do it together. It isn't one voice speaking here normally, I think. It is many voices, all praising God together and saying, for instance, it is good to sing praises unto our God, for it is pleasant, and praise is comely, as in the 147th Psalm.
Very good. Comely.
Praise is a lovely thing.
Yes.
Only distinguished people, of course, are capable of praising things or persons. You know, there are people who never praise anybody or anything. You probably have encountered such.
Yes, they are frozen.
For instance, I'm less interested.
Oh, sometimes, by the way, it's the result of shyness, isn't it?
No, I think it's a result of weakness. I'm less interested in Sidney Smith's fear that he will praise someone that doesn't deserve it than I am in someone who's afraid that he will not praise someone who does deserve it.
Or something, rather. Because you said before, one praises a quality.
Yes.
Something produced, something won't let himself go, won't let his feelings flow out of him.
Yes.
Grudging and a hesitant spirit.
But listen how the psalmist is always breaking forth, as in the 8th Psalm. O Lord, O Lord, how glorious is thy name in all the earth. It's as if he just realized it all over again. He looked about him and he considered everything. O Lord, O Lord, how glorious is thy name in all the earth, whose majesty is rehearsed above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings hast thou founded strength because of thine adversaries, that thou mightest still the enemy and the avenger. When I behold thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast established, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou thinkest of him? Yet thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, all of them, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how glorious is thy name in all the earth.
It's an organ tone, isn't it?
Yes.
You feel it appealing down the aisle of the...
And you know, it says actually a very complicated thing, too. It says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? The speaker realizes how little he is being a man.
This is the humility, the genuine humility we were speaking of.
Yes, and yet he points out that this little man who speaks thus to God, only one of his many, many creatures, nevertheless, by some decision of God, which the man at this point doesn't seem to be able to understand, and maybe he shouldn't try, by some decision of God has been placed over the other creatures, has been given dominion over them. I love the fear and trembling with which he accepts that responsibility.
By the way, you know, you talk of the complexity of the ideas very correctly. In the Hebrew, there is an even greater complexity than appears in the English, because where the translation reads, I suppose properly, a little lower than the angels, in the Hebrew, the word that's used for angels is Elohim, a little lower than the gods.
Than the god.
Which is a very odd term.
You mean there's a plural there?
There's a plural there. Mm-hmm. A little lower than the gods, or sometimes the word Elohim is used for God himself. You might say a little lower than God himself. There is apparently a hint there as to the impropriety of placing something in between man and God. The next stage after God is man, not the angels, because the angels, having no power to do evil, don't share in the merit of doing good. those creatures which haven't the capacity to choose naturally don't get the credit for having made the choice.
Yes.
So that a little lower than the Elohim means a little lower than the gods, God himself, just the next stage.
Yes. And yet, he is that we are a created thing. Sometimes the psalmist merely repeats phrases of peace. It's as if he were a musical instrument. In the 47th psalm, he breaks out, "Sing praises to God, sing praises. Sing praises unto our King. Sing praises." The repetition of that phrase, to me, is particularly touching. But then at other times, he develops a complicated idea, such as that one we spoke of, or the one in the 29th psalm, when, once more, now it isn't as if he, so much that he looks about him and sees how the mountains and the skies and the trees and the animals express God. Now God is expressing himself. The very world is his voice. "The voice of the Lord is upon the waters. The God of glory thundereth. Even the Lord upon many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaketh the cedars. Yea, the Lord breaketh in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. He maketh them also to skip like a calf, Lebanon and Syrian like a young wild ox. The voice of the Lord heweth out flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shaketh the wilderness. The Lord shaketh the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord maketh the hinds to calve and strippeth the forests bare. And in his temple all say, glory. The Lord sat enthroned at the flood. Yea, the Lord sitteth as king forever. The Lord will give strength unto his people. The Lord will bless his people with peace."
Tremendous. It's a tremendous thing. And I keep on asking myself, why is it we can't create a comparable, modern, scientific, dithyramb, dealing with the world? We found out, presumably, how much more wonderful the world is than they knew 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. Say, let us say this was written 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago. They didn't know how wonderful the world was.
That's
presumably,
right.
Did they? They didn't know all about the atom and the subatomic particles and the
space.
They
didn't know how big it was
and
how
little. Yeah, and the bending of that space is bent and all the infinite marvels that are discovered in biology and in genetics and in mathematics. They didn't know it. Why haven't we got a comparable literature of astonishment at the marvels of the world?
Well, we spend
what is it that chokes us?
Well, we spend our time praising the men who found these things out. We praise the scientist. We don't praise God who made both the world and the studies and the scientist. No,
there's a phrase.
No, I'll tell you what. There's a very curious reflection that this promotes in me. The men who wrote the Psalms proved their greatness by their capacity to understand how much greater than they, something or somebody else was, namely God. You see, what proves anyone's greatness is his capacity to recognize greatness in others. There may be a paradox.
Oh, yes. No, there is a paradox that amounts to this, that what's happening to modern man is how wonderful I am to understand all this.
That's right. Exactly.
Instead of having the attitude, how wonderful that is
to be understood by me.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to interrupt you to ask whether you...
Well, you're not interrupting me. We're just talking.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask, it's not quite apropos. Among these psalms of phrase, there's one in which a very familiar phrase appears. It's always impressed me, and I can't quite get the meaning in its literal sense. We've been talking about the way they use a three-dimensional and the palpable, the obvious, the visible, in order to express intellectual ideas. And he says, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Yea, lift them up, ye everlasting doors, that the King of glory may come in." Now, do you see that lifting up the head of the gate, was there some kind of a mechanism that they had to lift up before the gate could be rolled back? How do you see that figure of speech?
I've read that psalm to myself many times, often in a room where I've closed the door, because I love to sort of thunder that psalm.
Yes.
And I never thought about what its meaning was until this summer when we knew we were going to talk about the psalm. But I've looked up many commentaries on the passage. None of them is very satisfactory to me. I wish I never had looked up any of them, but the gist of them seems to be this, that the reference is to the gates of the temple. Is that true, the gates
of
the temple?
Yes, of course, but what does it mean, lift up? It isn't like a curtain. It's like, it's as though there was something, the gate isn't a curtain, there must have been some kind of device on top which held it in its place, mm-hmm. and they said, lift up your heads. When you've lifted up the head, you can roll back. You can roll back the gate. But in any case, it makes a tremendous phrase.
Well,
lift up your heads, O ye gates! Lift them up, ye everlasting doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who then is the King of Glory? The Lord of Hosts. He is the King of Glory. I mean, there's a proud, a magnificent chant going back and forth. Whom are you speaking of? I'm speaking of the Lord of the Universe.
Yes. Well, I was glad that you read more of that psalm, because it is one, as I say, that has always given me intense and even mysterious pleasure. And I think formerly I may have had just as good a notion as I have of it now, that I've tried to find out what it means to others. Because after all, what a poem means to you may be just as important as what it means to others. I think it used to mean merely this, that the gates were addressed as living things, things with ears, things that could lift themselves.
Yes, well, that apropos of what you said, something recurs to me. Many years ago, I read one of the Psalms and hadn't looked at the Hebrew. In one of the Psalms, it speaks of God and the dead. He said, He giveth His beloved peace.
Yes.
Now, I thought it meant He gives His peace, which is so beloved, to someone.
Oh, yes.
That's what I thought. Then I looked up the Hebrew, He giveth peace to His beloved.
Yes.
And there still remains with me that first form, which is very precious to me. He giveth His beloved peace, His peace which is beyond understanding. He giveth His beloved peace. So that that occurs to me in connection with what you've correctly said just now, namely that whatever it means to you, if it has deep meaning, that was implicit in what the poet wanted to say.
Yes. Those misunderstandings, if that's what they are oftentimes most creative things. I happened to be speaking last evening with someone, and I was telling him about our reference to the line in one of the Psalms, which is so often misread, a very present help in trouble. I said it was often read, in a very present help in time of trouble. And this person to whom I said this said, well, isn't that the way it is? Well, I got a copy of the Bible and showed him. He said, oh, dear, I suppose it was just the natural tendency of everybody who speaks English, at any rate, to write an iambic pentameter line, because that's what the line comes out as.
Oh, yes.
A very present help in time of trouble.
Yeah, but a little glib, isn't it?
You'd have
rejected that line yourself in one of your poems.
Yes.
You know, it reminds me of Mark Twain's remark about that poem of Byron's. You remember, the Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. It's the poem about Sennacherib descending on Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And Mark Twain says it sounds just like buttermilk gurgling out of an arrow-necked bottle.
Well, now, these are first great poems, and that is never true of them. For one thing, they don't have any words in them that are just stuck in to fill out some form. Every word in them counts.
Yes, it's both inevitable and unpredictable.
That's right, and I hope next week we shall be able to continue to talk about the Psalms this way, about them as the noblest works of praise that we have, and to continue reading them.
The National Broadcasting Company has presented The Words We Live By, the 13th in the 14-week Eternal Light Summer Series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of the Psalms as great human documents. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.